Thank you for joining us this evening as Sharshara presents Navigating the Complicated World of Advanced Breast and Ovarian Cancer. Tonight's webinar will focus on the unique concerns of those of you currently living with or touched by advanced cancer. We have presented prior webinars that address the needs of women at all stages of breast or ovarian cancer, and we encourage you to go to our website to access these transcripts and audios. My name is Shira Dubitsky, and I'm the Director of Navigation and Support Services at Sharsharet. And much of my day is spent speaking with women, family, and friends who are living side by side with advanced cancer. And I'm excited to hear the information tonight, as I imagine it will enhance my work with you and that you as well will find the information impactful and purposeful. I'd like to begin by thanking Amgen for sponsoring tonight's webinar and for their ongoing generous support of Sharsharet. I would also like to express our gratitude to our partners, FORCE, Living Beyond Breast Cancer, Metastatic Breast Cancer Alliance, Ovarian Cancer Research Fund Alliance, and Young Survival Coalition for their partnership and coalition. So a little bit about us. Sharsharet supports women and families facing breast and ovarian cancer at every stage. Our expertise is in young women and Jewish women, though we offer support to everyone reaching out to us. We help you connect to our community, whatever your personal background, stage of life, genetic risk, diagnosis, or treatment, and all of our services are personalized, confidential, and free. Increments of good news are worth sharing. There is a recent National Cancer Institute study that found that women with advanced breast cancer are surviving longer. The lead author, Angela Mariotto of NCI, called the findings favorable because they were partly due to longer survival times resulting from better treatment. So this is indeed uplifting news, and we, of course, hope that the trajectory continues in this direction. As the medical landscape of advanced cancer changes and as your journey moves forward, Sharsharet is with you. Our Embrace program for women living with advanced breast cancer and ovarian cancer is tailored to meet the needs of each woman and her family. So we offer free one-to-one phone support counseling as needed, as well as customized resources that meet your unique needs. I particularly want to highlight our survivorship kit that you can personalize. So in there, you'll find a care plan, resources and information, a healthy cookbook, and a pedometer. And you can order this kit directly from going to our website at www.sharsharet.org. We're also excited to announce that we will soon be launching our Sharsharet Embrace Facebook group for those of you living with advanced breast cancer or ovarian cancer. Our goal of this closed Facebook group is to offer you a safe space to meet other women who are living side by side with metastatic breast cancer or recurrent ovarian cancer. And in this group, we encourage you to share your experiences, knowing that other women in this community are experiencing similar challenges and hardships, moments of laughter, and really just life-changing insights. So we will share more information about when we are officially launching and how to join this Facebook community via email when we send out the transcript and recording from tonight's presentation. We are excited to have Dr. Adam Brodsky, who is joining us this evening. He is professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and also serves as the associate division chief for the Division of Hematology Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine's Department of Medicine. Dr. Brodsky is the medical director of the Women's Cancer Center at McGee Women's Hospital of University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. He is also an associate director for clinical investigations and co-director of the Comprehensive Breast Cancer Center. As an active researcher, he has published numerous abstracts and research articles in leading journals and is principal investigator on a number of research grants funded by the National Institutes of Health, Susan G. Komen Foundation, and the U.S. Army Breast Cancer Research Program. So, Dr. Brodsky, the proverbial floor is yours.
Great, and thanks a lot. Let me go to the next slide just to get everything started. Just a few things. First of all, I think the most important thing that was said in the last 5 minutes is that people with advanced breast cancer are living a lot longer, and I think it's really great. I've been doing this and have devoted my kind of career over the last 25 years to the treatment and research of metastatic breast cancer in particular, and it's really gratifying. I think I started to see this in my own practice probably 5 or 6 years ago, that women really are starting to live a lot longer, and that's really good, and kind of we're going to talk a little bit tonight. I'm probably going to skip through a lot of the slides I have because I have a lot of information to go through. But basically, you know, that the fact that women are living longer has some issues with it, which are good issues to have, but we even have better to do, and we have even more exciting new things that are coming down the pike. So with that, why don't we get started? Next slide, please. So breast cancer is, as we all know, the leading cancer cause of death in women. There'll be about 250,000 new cases this year, about 40,000 deaths. And the idea is that it really was one of the first diseases, the first cancers, where we realized that biology was the main driver of treatment, and we tried to tailor the treatment based on the biology of the cancer, in particular the receptor for estrogen and the receptor for HER2. And that really has kind of guided us over the last 15 or 20 years in how we treat metastatic disease. Next slide. So what I'm going to talk about today are bones and metastatic breast cancer. Because this is a Jewish breast cancer organization, we'll talk a lot about BRCA-associated breast cancer. Some very exciting things are going to happen at this year's annual ASCO meeting in a few weeks. And we'll talk a little bit about palbociclib and immunotherapy, both of which I think have the potential. Palbociclib is clearly revolutionizing the treatment of breast cancer, and immunotherapy may. Next slide. So the idea is that when women live longer with metastatic breast cancer, they are going to live longer, potentially have more side effects. And in particular, those side effects are going to be in the bone. Metastatic bone disease is very prevalent. You know, probably between 40 and 60% of women who develop a metastatic disease will have bone metastases. And in fact, the longer women live, it can be up to 70%. And so this is a big issue. Next slide. Because with a bone metastasis, you can get a lot of what are called skeletal-related events over time. You can get a fracture of a bone, which can be devastating, the need for radiation to the bone, need for surgery to the bone, spinal cord compression, where the cancer actually escapes the vertebral body and actually compresses your spinal cord and causes paralysis. You can also get hypercalcemia malignancy, where the bone secretes a lot of calcium, and that causes all sorts of metabolic problems. And so these bone metastases, though, can really affect a lot of issues and really make someone's quality of life miserable. I mean, you could live 6, 7, 8 years now with bone metastases, if not longer, but you could be miserable if you're in pain all the time. So we really want to do things to stop that. Next slide. The rate of these skeletal-related events is quite high. As you can see here, this is actually the placebo arm of a trial long ago of a bisphosphonate. And you can see that about 50% of women develop a pathologic fracture. About 70% of women will develop some sort of skeletal-related event. So this is an important issue. Even though people may come with, say, one or two bone metastases, you know, we really want to try to prevent these skeletal-related events. Next slide. So how do we do that? Next slide. So the idea here, again, is that osteoclasts, which are shown in the bottom part of this figure, they're normal cells that chew up bone. And normally they're under control by a lot of mechanisms in the cell, but if a cancer cell comes near them, the cancer cell will secrete all sorts of growth factors that cause the osteoclast to kind of chew up more bone. The osteoclast then secretes growth factors that cause the cancer to grow, so it's a vicious cycle. So the idea is to give drugs like bisphosphonates, and I think people who have advanced cancer who are on this call or know people with advanced cancer know what those are. There's a drug called zoledronic acid, which is intravenous. There's other ones called clodronate, which is oral, or ibandronate, which is oral. And the idea behind these drugs, which have been used for osteoporosis for years, it's to kind of break the cycle by kind of slowing down the osteoclast. That's the idea behind this. Next slide. So this just shows you kind of the reduction in the risk of skeletal-related events with all of these drugs. Zoledronic acid is shown up at the top. It's about a 60% reduction. Some of the other bisphosphonates like pamidronate, which is intravenous, ibandronate, which is Boniva, clodronate, which is not available in the U.S., all can reduce the risk of skeletal-related events by about 20 or 30%, but generally zoledronic acid works the best. And I think that's really what, until very recently, has been used as the standard of care in this disease. Everybody who gets Zometa They come in once a month to their doctor if they have metastatic disease to bone and get it. Next slide. But recently there have been newer drugs, and the idea is that there's a protein called RANK ligand, which binds to something called RANK receptor on osteoclasts. And when that happens, those osteoclasts are activated. What you can do is make this monoclonal antibody, and it's a mimic of a protein called osteoprotegerin. And denosumab, or XGEVA, is actually a mimic of this antibody, which coats the RANK ligand receptors, and therefore they can't stimulate the osteoclast. Next slide. And when that happens, actually, denosumab works a little bit better than zoledronic acid. It reduces the risk of skeletal-related events by about 20% or so. And as a result, it really now has become the standard of care. Everybody will likely get XGEVA, or denosumab, which is the generic name, once a month, instead of zoledronic acid. However, it depends on what part of the country you're in, because some insurances don't allow denosumab because zoledronic acid is generic and therefore theoretically at least a little bit cheaper. They both work relatively the same, I think, clinically, and I think it's okay to get Zometa instead of XGEVA. But on the other hand, I think that most people use this, one of these two, to protect themselves against bone complications. Next slide. So the real, I think the big thing that's happened in this business in the last couple of years is how often we should be giving them. Everybody generally gets them monthly, but it turns out, next slide, that we can actually start giving them every 3 months. This is a trial called Optimize, and this is patients who already were on zoledronic acid, and they were randomized to get it monthly or every 3 months. Next slide. And when that was done, the rate of skeletal events was exactly the same. So it turns out that what we're all starting to do now is give you your zoledronic acid every 3 months instead of monthly. There's no data right now on XGEVA given every 3 months, although there's a Swiss trial that's going to report out in a couple months or maybe a year or two, and I think it'll probably be the same result where it's likely we're going to start giving these drugs every 3 months instead of monthly. When we do that, one of the rare but serious complications of this was called osteonecrosis of the jaw, where your jaw doesn't heal after an invasive dental procedure like an extraction, that's actually going to probably go down if you start giving these drugs every 3 months instead of monthly. Next slide. So what's new, actually, in metastatic breast cancer? Next slide. So this is a little bit complicated, but there have been drugs that have been developed, CDK4/6 inhibitors, and palbociclib, or Ibrance, is the most common one. And what they do is they interfere with this pathway. It's a shame I don't have an arrow to point this out. But for cells to go through what's called the cell cycle and divide, there's a protein called retinoblastoma that controls that. It's RB, and you can see it kind of in the middle. And it's bound to another protein called E2F. And the idea is that there are these proteins called cyclins, especially in estrogen receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer, that actually add phosphate groups to the RB, allowing the E2F to pop off and then start the cell cycle. If you have a CDK4/6 inhibitor, it blocks that phosphorylation, that adding of phosphates to the RB so the cell cycle can't start. These drugs apparently only work in estrogen receptor positive metastatic breast cancer. They may work actually in HER2 positive breast cancer, but the trials are not out yet. They definitely do not work in triple negative breast cancer. Next slide. So these are the ones that are actually out there. There's palbociclib, which was approved, LEE01, which is ribociclib or Kisqali. That just recently got FDA approved, and the abemaciclib actually has data that's going to be presented at our ASCO meeting, and it will likely be approved over the summer. So we're going to have all three of these drugs. They have slightly different side effects, but they all tend to work basically the same way. Next slide. For palbociclib, there was a large trial called Paloma-2, which is about 666 women who basically had metastatic breast cancer that was estrogen receptor positive, and they had no prior therapy for their metastatic disease, and they were randomized to letrozole or Femara, which is a standard therapy with or without palbociclib. Next slide. And what was really dramatic is that the length of time these women lived without the cancer progressing doubled from about 15 to 16 months to about 30 months. So that's 2.5 years now that a woman with estrogen receptor positive metastatic breast cancer can live without her cancer getting worse. And we believe that's going to improve people's overall survival from this disease dramatically, and I think we're all looking forward to data either at this ASCO meeting or the San Antonio meeting in the fall or in the winter or even ASCO 2018. I think we're going to start to see some data that's going to be very, very exciting. Next slide. The only side effect of these drugs is a reversible white count, a reversible neutropenia. It's not like the neutropenia from chemotherapy. Once you stop the drug, The neutrophils recover almost within a day or two. So really, it's really a very well-tolerated, very easy-to-manage drugs. Now, clearly, there are rare side effects that people get, like fatigue, but generally, these drugs are very easy to take. Next slide. There was another trial, actually, where we used these drugs that people had progressed from their disease, and this is Paloma 3. These are women who were now in the second line. They had already had a first-line hormonal therapy, and they were given palbociclib. They were given fulvestrant or Faslodex, which is a standard intravenous shot that you get once a month that works pretty well with or without palbociclib. Next slide. And palbociclib did the same thing. It doubled the amount of time that these women did well without their cancer progressing. And in fact, even though this says 9.2 months, it's more like about a year to 13 months in the latest data. And this is really a doubling or almost tripling of that time. And in fact, this will likely improve people's overall survival for metastatic breast cancer as well. Next slide. Again, the only side effect that you see is a reversible neutropenia or low white count. Most people do pretty well with these drugs. Next slide. So a few other things, and then we'll kind of turn it over to our ovarian colleague. The first one that I think is really, really interesting is that it turns out about 10% of the time, now that we've learned how to do large-scale DNA sequencing of cancers, and we're starting to do this for a lot of people, we're finding about 10% of the time if you have estrogen receptor positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer, that you've acquired a mutation in HER2, and that mutation can actually be treated. So this is actually just showing you that this is one particular set of data where they found mutations in HER2 in about 7% of patients. It's actually anywhere from 7 to 15% of women with estrogen receptor-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer actually have HER2 mutations. Next slide. And this just shows you, again, you can go to the next slide, it shows you where they are. Next slide. So this is a trial called Summit, and this is some of the preliminary data from it. And what this shows is that these women who've been treated with multiple other therapies and have progressed through everything, when we treat them with neratinib, which is an oral agent that inhibits a mutated HER2 receptor, it's called a HER2 tyrosine kinase inhibitor, when we give that with Faslodex or fulvestrant, even if these women have had fulvestrant before, most of them either have stable disease or they respond. So if those blue bars go down, it means people are responding. So really, I think this is really, really exciting, and it's one of the things that we're thinking about using large-scale DNA sequencing of people to find these mutations and maybe change their therapy. Next slide. So what about triple-negative breast cancer? It's about 15% of all breast cancer, and the problem with this is that we really have no therapy other than chemotherapy that's proven to work in it. That's the problem. And chemo sometimes in triple-negative breast cancer doesn't even work that well. Next slide. So one thing that's interesting about triple-negative breast cancer is that it has what's called homologous recombinant repair deficiency. So what that means is that the DNA has trouble repairing itself. So DNA in cancer cells is continually kind of being growing and it's kind of replicating all the time, and that introduces a lot of mutations into the DNA, and they have to be fixed. And it turns out that if the DNA breaks in half, it's called the double-stranded DNA break, that in BRCA-associated breast cancer, that's the problem, is that you get a double-stranded DNA break that you can't repair. Well, it turns out in some percentage of triple-negative breast cancer, even over and above BRCA1 or 2 mutations, which here accounts for about 15%, there's probably another 45% that may have kind of this deficiency in DNA repair. And so why is that important? Next slide. That's important because we have a lot of these PARP inhibitors. And what these do is that they inhibit single-stranded DNA repair, and what that does, it leads to a double-stranded DNA break that the cell can't repair. And all of these are very, very exciting. Next slide. And you can see here are all the trials that are going on. The big one is called Olympiad. That's the second one down. It was a trial of first-line metastatic breast cancer that's triple-negative and BRCA positive. The women were randomized to olaparib or standard chemotherapy, and this trial was very positive to the point where it is in the plenary session of ASCO. That means it's going to be a big deal, and so we're all waiting for this. It's going to be about in 2.5 weeks we're going to see it. I think it's Sunday, June 4th, I think, we're actually going to see the announcement of this particular study. And I'm sure the ovarian person that's going to talk after me is going to talk a little bit more about PARP inhibitors and ovarian cancer, but I think this is now going to introduce PARP inhibitors to breast cancer. Next slide. So the last thing really to talk about is the immune response. And it turns out that, again, this is one of many complicated slides, but the bottom line here is that cancer cells have evolved ways of turning off the immune system. So what happens is that you can have all these kind of proteins on the surface of a breast cancer cell called antigens, and your T cells can react to them and start growing and trying to attack. But there's a receptor called PD-1 that binds to a ligand called PD-L1 on the cancer cell that turns the T cells off. So these guys have figured out an antibody that coats that PD-1 receptor and blocks that kind of break. So that lets the T cells kind of start growing a lot again, and it works really well in melanoma, it works really well in lung cancer, it works really well in bladder cancer, in some lymphomas and leukemias, and now we're trying to see whether it works in triple-negative breast cancer. Next slide. So this just shows you this PD-1, PD-1L1 pathway, you know, showing you that the cancer cells can block it. PD-1 binds to the PD-L1 on the cancer cell and actually turns off the immune system so it can't work. Next slide. So this is pembrolizumab, which is a monoclonal antibody that binds to PD-1 and blocks an interaction, so therefore the cancer cells can't be turned off. They keep growing. Next slide. Or the immune cells keep growing. And this just shows you that this was, again, tried in triple-negative breast cancer with a lot of, that had a lot of therapies already, like 3 or 4 therapies. These were women who had gone through a lot of different things. And you can see about half of the women had either stable disease or responded to this. And this is not, you know, it doesn't look great, but on the other hand, it is a signal, and it got us all very excited. And so now we're doing these big phase 3 trials with immunotherapy for triple-negative breast cancer. Next slide. And this just shows you, this is called the IMPASSION 130 study. It just closed. It took women, actually, it said 350. We actually ended up accruing about 650 women, all of whom got nanoparticle paclitaxel or Abraxane, with or without a drug called atezolizumab, which is a PD-1L1 monoclonal antibody. And the whole idea is to see whether we can improve the time that women live without progression of their cancer. This trial accrued. It's all done. We'll know the results within about probably 9 months. So, again, I think it's really exciting. Next slide. And so I think we'll kind of stop. I think I kind of did my 20 minutes. I got through these slides in 20 minutes. And the bottom line is that bone-targeted agents given every 3 months can reduce skeletal-related events, so I suspect oncologists are going to start doing this every 3 months. I think CDK4/6 inhibitors are very exciting and may show a survival benefit. I think HER2 mutations are really cool and may be another way to treat women who've gone through a lot of different hormonal therapies. And finally, I think the big news of at least the next 3 or 4 months in breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, is going to be the use of PARP inhibitors in metastatic breast cancer, and maybe next year's big thing will be immunotherapy. So again, thank you all, and I think after the ovarian person, I'll answer questions. Thank you very much.
Great. Dr. Brodsky, thank you so much. You actually covered a lot of material in 20 minutes, and that I hope that the participants on the call tonight, that you'll bring some of this information back with your doctors for a deeper discussion. I particularly appreciated your optimism when you were talking about not only the quantity of life and that women are living longer, but I also appreciate that you were talking about the importance of quality of life and the hopeful message that you gave around those women who are living with triple negative breast cancer, particularly in BRCA. So thank you very much. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mira Hellman. Dr. Hellman specializes in gynecologic oncology. She treats all subtypes of gynecologic cancers, including uterus, cervix, fallopian tube, ovaries, primary peritoneal, vaginal, and vulvar cancers. Her research focus is in clinical research, including cooperative group studies and well and industry-sponsored and investigator-initiated. She enjoys having the opportunity to offer patients the possibility of participating in the most cutting-edge research if they're inclined to do so. Dr. Hellman was active in resident and student education and received several awards in resident education. She also helped spearhead a comprehensive center for minimally invasive surgeons across multiple cancer specialties. She is currently practicing at the John Thurer Cancer Center at the Hackensack University Medical Center. And in the short time since she has joined the Hackensack Medical Center, Dr. Hellman has spearheaded an IRB-approved study looking at sentinel lymph node dissection for patients with endometrial cancer. She is currently active in proposing another study to the IRB to improve patients' post-operative pain control. Dr. Hellman?
Good evening. Thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity to speak to you about the topic of recurrent ovarian cancer. First of all, I'm happy that Dr. Brodsky touched on several issues that we will be touching on tonight as well. But I'm going to go ahead and get started because our time is limited. Next slide, please. Next slide. So ovarian cancer is the fifth leading cause of cancer-related mortality in women worldwide. It is the leading cause of death from gynecologic cancer. There are approximately 21,000 new cases diagnosed annually, and this is from the most recent data from the 2016 SEER database. Now, as you can tell from the slide here, recurrence of ovarian cancer is directly related to the stage at presentation. Unfortunately, approximately 75% of women present in advanced stage. And if you look at the slide, that will lead to about a 70 to 95% chance of recurrence for these women. Next slide. This is a basic diagram looking at recurrent ovarian cancer. The timing and the management of recurrent ovarian cancer is directly related. And it's almost, the timing of recurrence almost treats different disease processes. So if you look at this diagram, the most resistant recurrence to treat is the refractory cancers. These refractory cancers are basically cancers that don't respond to initial treatment and grow right through the treatments. And as you go further down this diagram, you will see recurrences that are more and more sensitive to treatments. We're going to focus on two very basic different type of recurrences. One is the platinum-resistant recurrence or primary-resistant recurrence, and the second one is the platinum-sensitive or the sensitive recurrence, and that's B and D on this diagram. Next slide, please. And this is a timeline in terms of the recurrences and where they fall. Refractory is at the onset where patients grow right, where, disease grows right through chemotherapy. Then there's a platinum resistant where the recurrence occurs early on, and it's usually defined as a recurrence that occurs within the first 6 months after the completion of initial treatment. Platinum sensitive recurrence, on the other hand, is a recurrence that occurs more than 6 months, and some people use the definition of a year, after the completion of initial treatment. Next slide. Next. So what are the symptoms of recurrent ovarian cancer? Bloating, next. Constipation, next. Pain, next. Nausea. These are some of the most common symptoms that patients present when they develop a recurrence. As you can tell, unfortunately, these are not very specific symptoms, and it really behooves both the physician and the patient to be very alert to these very subtle symptoms that can be indicative of recurrent ovarian cancer. Next slide. Now, how do we diagnose or establish a diagnosis of recurrent ovarian cancer? It's a combination of different factors. Physical exam, sometimes there's a mass that's palpable on exam. Patients can develop recurrent ascites, pleural effusions, which is fluid around the lungs. CA-125, as I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, is a tumor marker that's used to monitor patients with ovarian cancer. And if we notice an elevation, either above baseline for the patient or above the normal range, that can be an indication of recurrent cancer. And then we oftentimes use imaging, such as a CAT scan, a CT scan, or a PET CT, to help diagnose or identify lesions in term, and establish a recurrence. Now, when looking at recurrent ovarian cancer, the question is a biopsy necessary? And this is really very individual, and it depends on the specific clinical scenario. Once a diagnosis of recurrent cancer is made, the question is when to start treatment and what to use in terms of treatment. Next slide. Here's just a slide basically looking at imaging modalities and ovarian cancer. On the left-hand side, you have a plain CT scan. If you look at the top image, you'll notice, I don't know how I can, you guys see my arrow? No, you can't, right? Well, on the top image, there's basically no evidence of disease, and the area that's lit up really is bladder. And if you look at the bottom image, there is a central mass that looks like a very dark black spot in the middle image. The middle image is the PET scan. And on the far right-hand side is a PET scan superimposed onto a CAT scan. So you combine the two images on the left. Next slide. Next. So when looking at recurrence, one has to bear in mind what is the goals of treatment for recurrent ovarian cancer? Prolonged survival, controlled disease-related symptoms, delay time to progression, minimize treatment-related symptoms, and improve or maintain quality of life. It's important to be very clear and specific, both on part of the physician and on part of the patient, as to what are the goals, because this will definitely help tailor treatment. Next slide. Next slide. And we asked, you know, a couple of slides or two slides ago, when to start treatment. Arisen CA-125 or even evidence of recurrence within the absence of symptoms does not necessarily mean that treatment needs to start immediately. Now, a lot of people in the audience may feel very uncomfortable with this, and a lot of patients may feel very uncomfortable with this, but studies have shown that initiating especially chemotherapy treatments before onset of symptoms or significant disease burden, all it really does is subject patients to the unfortunate side effects of chemotherapy without necessarily improving outcomes. So it's very important to have this open discussion with a physician regarding exact timing of treatment of recurrence cancer. Next slide, please. Now, looking at the two different subtypes I said we would focus on, there's the platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer, and the mainstay of treatments in this disease is surgery in very limited clinical situations, chemotherapy, targeted therapies, and clinical trials. And the platinum-resistant recurrence, surgery, unfortunately, is not an option, has not been shown to be beneficial. So we focus mainly on chemotherapy. We are trying to develop more and more targeted therapies. Enrollment in clinical trials of utmost importance in platinum-resistant disease, given that our therapeutic options are so limited. And palliative care is something that is across the board underutilized in management of recurrent disease and recurrent cancers in general, specifically in terms of recurrent platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. Next slide. The role of surgery in recurrent disease is, like I stated earlier, somewhat limited. All of the data to date is retrospective in nature, meaning all the trials have looked back at patients who've had surgery to determine whether or not it's helpful. There are currently three major trials that are open looking prospectively at the utility of this surgery, but the data is not in yet. One of them is GOG-213, and there are two international European trials that are currently being conducted called Desktop and Soccer, but the results of these are not out yet. But this surgery is really limited to patients who have very limited disease, have no evidence of ascites, pleural effusion, or something called carcinomatosis, which is a fine spread of cancer throughout the peritoneal cavity. It's really not thought to be beneficial in these patients. Another surgical modality that has been looked at in ovarian cancer is something called HIPEC, which is hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And actually, Dr. Brofkiewicz at University of Pittsburgh, there's a big HIPEC group over there that some have been used for treatments in other cancers. Now, this mode of treatment really is basically taking patients to the operating room, removing tumor, and administering heated chemotherapy directly into the peritoneal cavity at the time of surgery. It's associated with a significant amount of morbidity, and therefore needs to be used very, very cautiously. There was actually a statement that was put out last year from the European National Group on Gynecologic Malignancies very clearly stating that to date there is not enough evidence to support the routine use of this surgical modality in management of recurrent ovarian cancer and really only should be limited to clinical trials due to the significant toxicity. Next slide. This is just a basic diagram. Recurrence, it's fine. Next slide. This is a diagram of the HIPEC, and as you see here, there is a chemotherapy that's heated and it's instilled into the peritoneal cavity, into the abdomen, and then drained out of the abdomen, reheated again, and recycled. Next slide. Once surgery is either performed or not performed, depending on the clinical situation, the next part of treatment is chemotherapy. In platinum-sensitive disease, we have very effective chemotherapeutic agents, and I tried to highlight here the important trials that have come out over the past decade or decade and a half. Then one of the most important trials was the ICOM-4 trial, which basically established that we should be really using at least two medications to treat platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancers, and that has shown to significantly improve survival. These other studies looked at different regimens, looking to decrease toxicity. The Calypso trial looked at a different combination of chemotherapies and was shown to have the same outcomes as what was at that time established chemotherapy regimen, but less toxicity. The OCEANS trial was a trial that looked at standard chemotherapies for platinum-sensitive recurrence, adding an agent called bevacizumab or Avastin, which showed improved survival. And most recently, hot off the press in March of 2017, the NOVA trial came out looking at the addition of what's called PARP inhibitors, which Dr. Brodsky touched on, as maintenance for platinum-sensitive recurrence. Now, the idea of maintenance in recurrent disease, maintenance basically means giving additional treatment after chemotherapy to help prevent recurrence, is a basically new concept. And this is the first time that actually there's FDA approval for one of these agents. Next slide. Next slide. I'm going to skip this diagram. Anti-angiogenesis agents have been studied and used extensively. And I just want to touch on two that are used very frequently in ovarian cancer. As many of you may be familiar with, Avastin or bevacizumab is an anti-angiogenesis agent that has been used in primary and recurrent ovarian cancer and has been shown to increase survival both in platinum-sensitive and in platinum-resistant recurrent disease. Cediranib is an angiokinase inhibitor, and that's actually currently undergoing investigation. In Europe, though, it has been approved for maintenance therapy in women with ovarian cancer in the ICON-6 trial. And most recently, it has been looked at in terms of combining it with olaparib, which is a PARP inhibitor, with promising outcomes. Next slide. So what's the mechanism of PARP inhibitors? I'm not going to repeat what Dr. Brodsky said. He basically went over this very clearly. But in ovarian cancer, it's particularly important, as stated, in patients who have a BRCA mutation, because this just adds to the damage that the BRCA mutations aren't able to fix and causes cell death, which results in treatment of the cancer. Next slide. Now, PARP inhibitors, there are three currently that have been approved in the treatment for ovarian cancer. The first PARP inhibitor that has been approved was olaparib, and that was approved for the treatment of patients who have received at least three previous chemotherapy agents but were still in the platinum-sensitive range. But it's only approved for patients who are BRCA mutation carriers, specifically diagnosed with the BRCA analysis CDX testing. And this was in 2014. In 2017, niraparib was approved after the results of the NOVA trial, which I talked to you about in the previous slide, with maintenance and platinum-sensitive recurrence in BRCA mutation carriers and in non-BRCA mutation carriers. So even though this is a PARP inhibitor, the approval for this was not limited only to patients who have a BRCA mutation, but also to patients who do not have a BRCA mutation. It did not improve survival as much, but it was definitely extremely effective in improving survival versus patients who did not have PARP inhibitors at all. Next slide. Rucaparib is the third PARP inhibitor to recently achieve approval. And it's approved for the use after two prior chemotherapy agents as opposed to olaparib, which we saw in the previous slide was approved for the use after three previous treatments, and this was approved in December of 2016. The important difference is this was approved for patients who have BRCA mutations or something called loss of heterozygosity, and patients who have these abnormalities that are diagnosed with the use of the foundation focus BRCA testing. So what's interesting is that the foundation-focused BRCA testing looks for both germline mutations or inherited mutations of BRCA, as well as somatic or acquired mutations of BRCA. Next slide. Next slide. So, most of the things that we talked about up till now were in platinum-sensitive recurrence. Platinum-resistant recurrence are unfortunately much more difficult to treat. There is limited treatment options of chemotherapy agents, although there's a long list of chemotherapy agents that are effective. The utility of them is limited, and oftentimes patients end up going from chemotherapy agent to chemotherapy agent over a short period of time. To date, when selecting agents, the focus needs to be on limiting toxicity and obtaining the best outcomes. The Aurelia trial was one of the few trials that showed improved in outcome, even in patients with platinum-resistant disease, and that was with the addition of Avastin or bevacizumab, and you can see that noted in the middle of the slide. Integration of palliative care is extremely important in this situation for these patients. As we stated earlier, surgery has a very limited role, but consideration really needs to be given to molecular profiling and enrollment of clinical trials. Next slide. Now, targeted therapies is something that is a major focus amongst many cancer specialties. When you look at the NCCN guidelines for treatment of ovarian cancer, there's a very exhausted list of different chemotherapies that are approved. Literally, it's like a couple of pages. But when you look at targeted therapies that are approved, there are only three targeted therapies that are currently approved for treatment of ovarian cancer, and that's bevacizumab, olaparib, and rucaparib. And I think these were put out before niraparib was approved. But that's pretty much it. Next slide. And why is this important? Dr. Rofsky talked about different receptors, and that's also applicable to ovarian cancer in terms of using this to tailor treatment specifically to patients who have specific mutations or specific predisposition to these agents. I included here a little slide that explains it, but I don't think we have time to show this little slideshow. But basically, it just focuses on different receptors that are present in the ovarian cancer cells and why these targeted therapies are useful in the management of ovarian cancer. Next slide. Next slide. And here's a diagram of different mutations that are present in ovarian cancer and different areas that are potential targets for a targeted therapy. Next slide. Some of the agents that have been studied are, as we said earlier, anti-angiogenesis, which are VEGF receptor inhibitors, bevacizumab, otherwise known as Avastin, which a lot of you are familiar with. Angiokinase inhibitors inhibit PDGFR, sudarinib, pazopanib, and nintedanib. PARP inhibitors we talked about extensively. Vilaparib is still being investigated and has been promising. So the top three here have really been studied extensively and are currently approved for use in recurrent ovarian cancer. The bottom three are a little bit more limited. Folate receptor antagonists was thought to be promising, but really did not prove to be that beneficial. Herceptin, as much as it's used in breast cancer, unfortunately has not been a very good contender in treatment of recurrent or primary ovarian cancer. Hormone therapy is of limited use also in ovarian cancer, but sometimes can be used specifically for patients who are positive for a hormone receptor status, or patients who have just an elevated CA125 without clear evidence of cancer, but it is really of very limited use. And immunotherapy is currently being studied extensively, specifically checkpoint inhibitors, PD-1 and PD-L1. There is a phase 1 and some phase 2 data that look promising in terms of treatment of ovarian cancer, and currently it's actually being studied in trials looking at combining PD-1 inhibitors in combination with other agents to try to increase efficacy. Next slide. I'm going to skip this slide. Next slide. Precision medicine is basically trying to tailor chemotherapies to patient-specific cancer. Currently, most of it is not FDA approved. Foundation Testing is just one company that basically what they do is they take tumor, they analyze it for the molecular profile or the mutation that is driving the development of this particular cancer. Not everybody's ovarian cancer, but this specific particular cancer to help tailor chemotherapies to address the specific underlying mutations. The only testing that is currently FDA approved, which is what we talked about earlier, which is a foundation-focused CDX BRCA testing, which is used to determine whether or not patients would benefit from treatment with rucaparib. What I found is interesting is the Foundation Act. That's actually a serum blood test trying to find, identify molecular mutations and specific cancers. But as I said, all of this is pretty much on a trial basis, and as currently has not achieved FDA approval. I know there was some data out in ASCO last year. It is something that is helpful, especially in patients with platinum-resistant recurrent disease where the treatment options are limited, but please bear in mind that it is not an approved, not an approved test for management. Next slide. You know, we covered a lot of information in these slides. I hope that it was helpful to the vast audience here, but I wanted to drive a couple of points home. First of all, when going to talk to someone about management of recurrent ovarian cancer, it is very important to ensure that your doctor is specifically focusing the treatment on you with the specific condition, clinical situation that is present. The American Cancer Society actually advises to obtain second opinions, especially in recurrences where treatment recommendations may vary. When someone presents with a platinum-sensitive recurrence right off the bat, the management is pretty directed. But once we're talking about second and third line recurrences or recurrence in the platinum-resistant category, a second opinion may be of help. It's important to ensure appropriate genetic testing to be helpful both to you and your family. And I really want to drive the point home that, please, I want to emphasize that palliative care is very important in management of recurrent disease. It can really enhance quality of life without detracting quantity of life. And I also want to encourage strongly to consider enrollment in clinical trials, because this will not only offer treatments that are not currently approved, but also allow for the possibility of advancement of the field. Next slide. The next slide is a list of websites that can be helpful to obtain further information. Thank you for allowing me to present tonight, and I hope that this was a helpful presentation to you, and please feel free to address me with any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Hellman. This was indeed very comprehensive, and I appreciated your discussion of precision medicine and targeted therapies. And I particularly appreciated both you and Dr. Brodsky sort of sharing the hot off the presses, research and treatments that are really on the horizon, because that leaves us feeling very hopeful. And as you said, many of these things are becoming more and more promising. This slide, all these slides will be on our website. So if you're interested in checking any of these out, we will have that on our website when we post our transcript. I'd like to now introduce Dikla Benzivi. Dikla will share her personal story about navigating metastatic breast cancer. She has touched the lives of many, many women across the country, providing information, insight, guidance, and really offers an uplifting message. And we are honored to have Dikla on our Sharsheret's LA Regional Office Committee. So Dikla, go ahead.
Hi, Shara. Thank you. I want to thank Dr. Brodsky and Hellman for the insightful presentation. It's always good to see in a concise manner what the latest and greatest is happening out there for all of us with metastatic disease. And also thank you to Shara Sheridan and your partners, FORCED and Ovarian Cancer Research Fund Alliance, LEBC, YSC, and NBC Alliance, for collaborating and making this webinar possible. And for everyone listening in, you've made it through 50 minutes, and I appreciate you hanging in there to listen to me as well. So I appreciate that. Thank you. So again, my name is Dikla Benzivi, and I've been living with metastatic breast cancer for almost 15 years. It's been a long journey with a lot of challenges, and definitely not something I could have done all by myself. And navigating this difficult road is not easy. My specific breast cancer is what's considered triple positive, HER2 positive, ER positive, and PR positive. And my metastases was in lung and bone. So my bone metastases has resolved, and my lung metastases, I've been dealing with that for 10 years now. And I've been in continuous treatment since for 15 years. I was originally diagnosed at the age of 32. I've changed therapies due to progression nearly every 2 years or sooner. And I've been on over 10 cancer therapies. In fact, maybe half of the therapies I've been on were not around when I was initially diagnosed. So it's very hopeful hearing the stories about what's up and coming and what's existing, because we never know what comes up in the future that will benefit us and give us those extra years that we're seeking. My spine and lung metastases have caused issues. Back when I had the bone metastases, it was in my spine, and I did have one of those fractures that Dr. Brodsky mentioned as a skeletal-related event. And it was almost paralyzed me, but thankfully my spinal cord was preserved, even though the tumor ate up most of the vertebra in my spine. I needed spine surgery. I was in a back brace. It was a very, very difficult time. I was fully disabled. I've gone through lung surgeries and radiation therapies, chemotherapies, targeted therapies, I think hormonal therapies, immunotherapies, and I continue to undergo therapies now. In fact, I've gone through all the HER2-targeted therapies, and I'm about to start a clinical trial. So clinical trials are so essential. In fact, I signed my consent form yesterday. So it's a momentous occasion for me, and I hope that this new trial treatment drug, whether I get it or not, depending on the arm, will work for me. The journey has definitely been rocky, uncertain, and with definite ups and downs from times of near total disability and chaos and extreme pain to times of feeling excellent. There were years where I even almost forgot I was in treatment because I was feeling so good. Did I know back in 2002 that I'd still be here 15 years later? The answer is no. When I turned 40, I had a gigantic party because I didn't even know if I'd reach that. Will I be here in another 15 years? Well, I hope so. And I do the utmost that is in my control to make it happen. As for what I cannot control, and I think many of us dealing with advanced stage, either breast or ovarian cancer, or any type of advanced stage cancer, for what we cannot control and all that is uncertain, scary, our mortality, physically and emotionally uncomfortable, painful with this disease, I seek out lifestyle habits that work for me, mind-body practices, and nurturing supportive connections with peers and others to quiet the stormy seas in my mind and to learn and to ease the journey, not only for myself but for others as well. And I think as important as it is to deal with the physical side effects, it's just as important to deal with the emotional, spiritual, and mental side effects that go with it. And some of these effects are definitely treatment-induced, and others are situation-induced. It is a traumatic experience, but there we can deal with it. Many of us are living longer lives with metastatic disease, as Dr. Brodsky mentioned. Hallelujah. That's fantastic, but what I think a lot of us want is a guarantee of decades and not single digits, something we all want for ourselves. My story is not unique. I think some of us do better with metastatic disease, some do worse. My wish is for all of us dealing with metastatic disease to live full lives with a good quality of life. In detail, my cancer journey started 15 years ago. And my diagnosis was purely by surprise. I had a regular gynecological visit. She did a breast exam, thought, oh, I feel a cyst, go get it taken care of. And that's how it all started. I went to a breast center. I had a lot of firsts. My first mammogram, my first ultrasound, four biopsies later, and I get a diagnosis of malignant breast cancer. And more firsts, first scans and first IV. Such a chaotic time, that initial period of trying to figure out what's going on, working and dealing with my normal life, so to speak, and the chaos of figuring out what to do next. It was overwhelming. It was scary. I felt like I had to become an instant expert immediately. And also understanding the effects that the treatment might have on my fertility and how can I preserve that. Such a big issue for many of us who are diagnosed premenopausal. At the time, I had family support. I had siblings. My parents had passed away many years earlier from cancer themselves. And lots of issues to consider. Definitely my mortality, fertility. Could I work? Could I not work? What are my rights at work? Insurance issues, side effects. I was single, dating. What is that going to be like? And the stress of it all. As well as going to genetic counseling and then surgery. You can only imagine, and I'm sure a lot of you have experienced this yourselves, or your family members have as well. My biggest need was for information and understanding and help, practical help as well as emotional help. I was looking for other young women. I went to the Young Women's Conference back then, and it just nurtured my soul to be around other women who were feeling exactly the same thing I was, and also learning through the seminars presented what's available to us in support, in fertility preservation or family planning options, in treatment options, and so on and so forth, and support groups. I think it's essential for all of us to get that kind of support as well as the medical expertise. I went along with treatment, and then I had a crisis with my spine fracture that happened in 2004. They immediately put me in a chin to waist back brace. A very scary time. What are we doing? We changed therapies. I was on hormonal therapies with a bisphosphonate and HER2 therapies. And I needed my support group like you can't even imagine. The day I got my back brace, I went right to a metastatic cancer support group. I would call into the hotlines available through like Sharsheret and LBBC and the YSC and the other groups to get phone support, one-on-one counseling, and trying to get through each day the best way possible and trying not to be too hard on myself, because prior to cancer, it's sort of built into me as being kind of stubborn and trying to be as independent as possible. And when this spine incident happened, I was completely dependent. And how do you mentally cope with that, come to terms with that, validate it, and make it okay to ask for help? That help is essential in recovery and in dealing with a condition, as much as wanting to be as independent as possible. The years go by, I keep switching therapies, the treatment works, then doesn't work so well, lung metastases comes up, and dealing with that for 10 years, on and off, things work, then don't work, add therapy, side effects come up, dealing with new side effects, figuring out a new normal, and then treatment not working, and moving on like that. In the meantime, I worked at my old job for several years into my diagnosis until I could no longer work, and I went on disability. And I found a new passion, which is supporting my peers. When I saw something that was lacking, I went out and I wanted to create it. Back in the early 2000s, pre-social media time, I realized there wasn't a young women's support network in my community, so I created one. I just reached out everywhere, asked anyone who knew anyone, and we got together. I enjoy helping my community. It feeds my soul as well as helping others. And patient navigation, patient advocacy for young women with mets and for all women with metastatic disease is my passion and my calling. And it's what helps me live each day, as well as my family. I also created the largest Facebook support group for people with metastatic disease so that we can all network. And there are many groups out there. I think finding a group that really helps you, that makes you feel good, is important. And maybe one group doesn't do it, but there's many out there, and you can test them all out and find what really works for you. I'm a peer counselor with numerous national cancer hotlines. I'm active with Sharsheret and Sharsheret's California chapter, the Young Survival Coalition, LBBC, and many others. And it's not that everybody needs to be so involved in advocacy. It's more finding what gives you purpose each and every day and what you're able to do with the capabilities that you have now. And if your situation improves, then you change and you do whatever provides you fulfillment at this point in time, day by day, day by day. And we come to now, May 2017. For me, it's 12 cancer drugs later, 4 to 7 changes in therapy later, and hundreds of chemo infusions, thousands of cancer pills. I mean, I've been in chemo since 2011. I utilize complementary therapies. And when a progression hits, how do I cope? How do I navigate the system again to figure out what the best next steps? Obviously, consulting with my medical professionals, maybe getting second, third, fourth opinions, talking to my peers on chat sites, reading articles, and then finally sitting with all of that quietly and figuring out what I think will work for me. And everyone needs to do what works for them and feels right to them. Do I deal with side effects? Definitely. When I had the spine metastases, I had lots of pain. I could barely move, and my mobility was limited, and I had to deal with that. As the years passed, some of the treatments, I felt great. I wanted to continue with it forever, but I had progression. And currently, my side effects include neuropathy, anemia, fatigue, and GI issues. And I hope that this new clinical trial I start will keep me going for years to come. And if it ever does stop working, that all these new therapies that are being tested now will be approved and show to be very, very promising. And just skipping forward from one treatment to the next. Navigating advanced stage disease and all its complexities is tough. There's so many struggles and obstacles and challenges along the way, physical, emotional, life struggles, and finances, relationships, work. It takes a village, a nurturing, actively supportive village to get through this. If one doesn't already exist for you, then please take the guidance to create one for yourself. And it doesn't all come at once. It takes time to build and practice. It takes support and guidance. And there is guidance. There are resources and support for you out there, all for free. And please seek them out. They're available online, in person, or by phone. And you can learn about what's out there in complementary therapies and new medical therapies and peer support. And it comes from many places, including from just this webinar, share it. You go online, there's the Embrace program, free peer support. You can talk to a genetic counselor, as well as many other services. There's the Young Survival Coalition. They have meetup groups locally, as well as a hotline, and a Metastatic Navigator booklet that's fantastic. There's always my Facebook group and many other Facebook groups. If you're at high risk or dealing with a BRCA diagnosis, Metastatic Breast Cancer Alliance, Metastatic Breast Cancer Network, LBBC, SHARE has even a call-in support group for young women with metastatic breast cancer. So there's a lot out there. There's websites to help you with issues related to your job or employment. There's information out there dealing with fertility and family planning. So I would say peer support is hugely important to navigate the system, not just for getting practical information, but in getting emotional support. It's a scary path. Yeah.
Sorry, Thikla, I'm going to jump in there because you are giving so much information, and that I, just in the interest of time, I want to just say that I think a lot of the things that you're mentioning, I hope, when we launch our own Facebook page, that you will be reiterating these things because these are amazing resources. And I want to make sure that people know how to get these. So I hope on our Facebook page that we're going to be launching, you know, that you will be sharing this, and a lot of these will be on the transcript. So I'm sorry to just sort of jump in there, but
no problem. Can I just say one last thing?
Yeah, please do.
To reach out, I just wanted to say. What I wish for us all is to thrive, to find joy and fulfillment amidst and in spite of this difficult metastatic diagnosis, and to stick around as long as we can and help each other out to do well. So I wish continued thrivership to everyone.
So thank you. And I have to say, every time you said the words 15 years, I am sure that went straight to the minds and the hearts of many of the participants on tonight's call. So, Thikla, thank you. We now have a few minutes for question and answers. To ask a question, you can dial *1, and we will address the questions in the order that they are received. Dr. Brodsky, we did get a question where somebody asked that when they were originally diagnosed, they had one particular HER2 status, and then when they had a recurrence, the HER2 status changed. Can you maybe address that briefly?
Yeah, about 20% of the time it does change, and usually it changes from negative to positive, although it can go the other way. And I think that you got to be very careful when you analyze the HER2 on a specimen, because it could go from positive to equivocal. And I still think equivocal is considered positive. Some of us still believe equivocals are positive. So just be very, very careful. But this is why a lot of times when people have recurrences, we ask that people get re-biopsied to try to figure this out. I still would treat someone with HER2-derived therapy, because I think the downside risk is low and the upside risk is really high. So that's kind of been the way I take care of these patients who may or may not have switched from one HER2 status to the other.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Hellman, we had a question that came in. They just wanted, if you can just talk about the difference between precision medicine versus targeted treatment.
Well, it's not that there's a, you know, clear, defined distinction, precision medicine versus targeted treatment in terms of definition. The difference is precision medicine takes a specific cancer specimen and tries to tailor targeted therapies to that specific cancer specimen. So, for example, you take a piece of tissue or from someone's particular cancer and send it for profiling or molecular analysis, and then try to identify a targeted therapy drug that would address this person's underlying mutation. Does that clarify it?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, if not, we'll get a follow-up question. Okay. Dr. Brodsky, we have a question that came in. It says, is there a way to improve bone health after a metastatic diagnosis where the metastasis is to the bone?
Yeah, I mean, the big ways to do it really are what you do normally, calcium, vitamin D, and more importantly, when metastatic disease goes to the bone, we give everybody either Xgeva or Zometa. So it's either denosumab, a shot, or Zometa, and that usually given every 3 months will improve bone health dramatically, even more than any other kind of things you can do. But we always tell people if they can, do all the normal things you do, you know, try to get out, move around if you can, you know, take calcium and vitamin D. The same thing we tell people for osteoporosis. But on the other hand, most people are getting a bone-targeted agent, so bone health really is the big thing. You really should be on a bone-targeted agent if you have metastatic disease to the bone.
Okay. Thank you. Dikla, a question came out about clinical trials. The woman said that she's so overwhelmed trying to find the right clinical trial. Do you have a quick tip? In terms of how to go about finding the right clinical trial?
Well, I would suggest also speaking to your oncologist and even getting second, third opinions and asking them what clinical trials would they suggest and why. There's also in the breast cancer world, there's a site called breastcancertrials.org that offers personalized trial searches. And then Living Beyond Breast Cancer as well in their site has a metastatic breast cancer trial search engine that also will personalize it for you. So there's sites out there that can help you out, as well as speaking to medical professionals. And then sometimes reaching out in the chat rooms and forums and asking, you know, if someone has specific type and what type of trials they're on and what they think.
Okay. Dr. Brodsky, we had heard that that there is a very low percentage of women participating in clinical trials. I think the number somebody had quoted was 3%. What's your understanding of that?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, I think that, again, one of the many jobs that I do at the University of Pittsburgh is I'm associate chief for clinical investigation, so I'm in charge of trying to get all these people on trials. And you know, the problem is, A, the trials sometimes are very tightly written, so it's often very difficult to get on a trial. Number two, the trials are a lot of work, so sometimes if there's someone in a very busy practice, you know, it's kind of hard for them to get to do the work to put someone on a trial. And three, I just don't think they're explained enough to people. I think that the most important thing about any trial is that you're going to get the standard of care. That's really important. That's the minimum, is the standard. And potentially it's a standard plus is the way I always put it. And so, you know, it shouldn't be that part of it, the people being worried about the trial, you know, if you're a patient with metastatic breast cancer or ovarian cancer, being worried about a trial should be the least of the concerns. You know, it's more getting more resources to physicians to make a trial accrual easier. I think that's probably the biggest thing. and making the understanding about people that you're not a guinea pig, that you're getting the standard of care at a minimum. I think those are the two things that we need to do going forward to try to improve that number.
Thank you. Dr. Hellman, the question just came in. I'm sorry, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but is it unusual for someone with advanced ovarian cancer to have anaphylactic shock each time they get chemo?
Well, anaphylactic shock is an anaphylactic reaction. It might be what the person was trying to say. Platinum agents are used very often in the treatment of ovarian cancer, as you saw. And sometimes when patients are exposed to platinum agents, specifically carboplatin, and they're re-exposed to it again, they can develop severe allergic reactions to it. And also Taxol, which is used very often in the treatment of ovarian cancer, does have a fair incidence of hypersensitivity or allergic reactions, and rarely, I believe it's around 3% or so, patients can have an anaphylactic reaction to it. So that can occur. It's something that is fortunately rare.
Okay. And I guess this participant should certainly be bringing that up with the doctor, to obviously alert them to what the situation is, and hopefully the doctor will make the appropriate adjustments. I guess this is for both the doctors. In terms of palliative care, I think it's a scary word, and sometimes people associate palliative care with hospice care. Is there a difference? And if there is, can you just briefly address that? Maybe Dr. Borofsky and then Dr. Hellman, if you can jump in on that.
End-of-life care is only one part of palliative care. I think that it's important to get people involved in helping manage symptoms and psychology and a lot of other stuff that palliative care guys do. And palliative care people are very good at helping you focus on what your goals are of therapy. And I think that, we should be getting them involved earlier, mainly because I think we can kind of start talking about these goals of therapy questions, before it really becomes an end-of-life discussion. It's more of a life discussion. What do you want out of your therapy? What do you want to do? That sort of thing. And I think that the earlier we get people involved, the sooner we can have those sort of discussions.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And like I tried to point out in my presentation, I think it's an integral part in terms of management of recurrent cancers, where so many factors that goes into the management of the recurrence, not just the chemotherapy agents, but taking the person's whole life situation into account. And like Dr. Borofsky said, palliative care is not equal to hospice care. Palliative care focuses on improving quality of life in all stages, and it's a well-known thing in the oncology world that unfortunately is completely underutilized across all fields, and it's a big drive to try to improve the use of palliative care, and I think overall it will improve patient satisfaction throughout their treatments.
Okay. And it looks like we have one more question that came in, and that was a couple of times through the presentations that I think maybe Dr. Borofsky, maybe in yours, but certainly in Dr. Hellman, I'm sure this is true as well for ovarian, is the discussion about treatments that are approved in Europe and not necessarily here. So the question that came in is, why would that be?
Because the European authorities have a completely different mechanism and approval process than the United States. And so remember, we're different areas of the world. And so really what drugs are approved and what aren't really depends on what the authorities of those countries allow. That's the real reason more than anything.
And is there anything that a woman can do if there is something that has been approved in Europe and not yet approved here, but it looks like a promising treatment? Is there anything that she can do to have access to that?
Sometimes we get things called compassionate use. You can do what's called a compassionate use investigator new drug application, and that will allow us to do that sort of thing. We could do that potentially. It really depends on what the drug is, how available it is. I think that if it's a drug that's already commercially available, for one indication in the U.S. but not in other countries, that's one mechanism. Compassionate use is another if it's not available at all.
And I agree with that, especially, in the setting of recurrent ovarian cancer that's not platinum sensitive, where, options are limited, or specific situations where there are not really great alternatives available, it's oftentimes easier to obtain what Dr. Borofsky was referring to as the compassionate care, to have it approved for use in specific situations.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Sarah, can I make one point? It's Dikla.
Sure, please do, Dikla.
Just on the clinical trials part, just something to consider if you're looking at clinical trials. And for myself, my perspective is that clinical trials are just an additional treatment option in the whole scheme of treatment options that are available to a person at any one time. It's not like a separate window. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, and one or several of them might be clinical trials. But the other thing to consider is strategic planning. So if you do certain therapies now, if they're all being equal, what will keep clinical trials open for you in the next 3 to 6 to 9 months so that you're not excluding yourself from trials that are open now because you're going to go on certain therapies. So it's always good to discuss with your oncologist what's a good strategic plan for the future to keep the most options for me open now and later. And as for palliative care, I just consider it symptom management or quality of life improvement planning. So if there's issues that are happening in my body that aren't that are affecting my quality of life, then I'd go to palliative care to help with it, whether it's pain or neuropathy or other issues that maybe they can help find solutions for.
Thank you. Thank you. That was incredible that you added those two pieces. So I really appreciate that. Dikla, thank you. Everything at Shosheret is driven by the conversations and feedback that we hear from you. So we will be sending out an online evaluation, so please take a few moments to complete this about tonight's webinar because your feedback is invaluable to us. You can also access the transcript and the audio of this webinar at www.org/resources/transcript. And I also encourage you to check out other previous webinars and teleconference that may be helpful to you. I would like to thank Amgen again for their generous support in making tonight's program possible. I would also like to thank Dr. Brodsky and Dr. Hellman for your expertise. Again, I hope that many of you will use the information as a springboard to going back to your treatment team. And I also do want to particularly thank you, Dikla, for your expertise, both in terms of the breadth and depth of your experience and taking what they spoke about and really bringing that to life. So thank you very much. I also want to give a special shout out to Shira Kravitz, Shosheret's support program coordinator, for all the time and work she put into making this webinar such a success. And finally, I want to thank all of you for joining us this evening. If you would like to continue this discussion with a member of our support staff, please feel free to connect with us by calling the office, emailing us, or simply going online. I also want to invite you to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter, and again, to look for our email announcing the launch of our Embrace Community Facebook group, and we are here when you need us and as you need us. So have a good evening. Take care.